You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Thank you and good afternoon. In the next hour, you're going to have three themes, as it were, come through. One is partnership. The second is reparative action in relation to chattel slavery on the plantations in Barbados. And three is that our focus is practical. We're not here to theorize, we're here to talk about practical action. So those are the three things: partnership, and we'll talk about that in a second, practicality, and our focus is on reparative justice. But first, let us introduce ourselves and also introduce the institutions that we represent. So, Kevin, over to you.
Thank you, Duncan. Hi, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Kevin Farmer. I am the executive secretary of the Codrington Trust. What is that? The Codrington Trust is a trust responsible for the management of the Codrington Estates, which is 600 plus acres in the eastern parish of St. John in Barbados, which was bequeathed to the SPG in 1710 and handed over to the Codrington Trust in 1981-82. So I'll let that sink in. 1710-1983. And since 1983, the Trust has been responsible for the management and running of that estate. And part of that, of course, is why we're here today, to talk about what does reparative justice look like on a former plantation which was owned by an agency of the Anglican Church. So look forward to your questions, and hopefully we would have really good answers for you later on.
Thank you, Kevin. So I'm Duncan Dormer. I'm the Chief Executive of the United Society Partners in the Gospel, USPG. We were founded in 1701 as the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel in Foreign Parts. You can make your own judgments about that historically as a name. In 1710, we were bequeathed 700 acres in Barbados, and we inherited a plantation upon which there were between 250 and 300 enslaved African persons. And between 1712 and 1836, as a Christian mission organization, managed and ran that plantation, with the profits from that going in to support Christian mission in various parts of the world. So that's the shameful history that we have to work with as a mission agency. So that's the kind of background. In 2023, we sat down opposite, across the table to say, okay, so how can we go about the business of repair? What does that look like? And we've evolved a project called the Renewal and Reconciliation, the Codrington Project. So this is a project which has quite a number of different strands to it. And I think it's fair to say that very quickly we agreed on the agenda and what we were seeking to do. So the project at the moment is a 10 to 15 year timescale. USPG has committed to put in £7 million during that period of time. And after that, we'll kind of see where we are. But it is a journey of discovery. There is no doubt we will get things wrong. This is complex. And as we know, the kind of political situation, both in Barbados and in the UK around reparations, is complex. So we're feeling our way, and it's a bit of an open-ended journey. But we do have some clear actions and programs that we are seeking to pursue. And in 2024, we launched that project. At the very outset of that, the first thing that we did and I did as the person who walks in the shoes of those who ran SPG in the past, the first thing we did was a public, fulsome apology for what had taken place within our history, taking collective responsibility, myself and our group of trustees, some of whom are in this audience today, for what we had done as an organization. But apology is not enough. You need a full truth-telling, an acknowledgement of what has happened, and then you need to act and to do things. So we've come up with five strands of action. Today we're going to focus on three of those, and we hope to be joined by colleagues in Barbados. But those five pillars or strands, I'm just going to pass over to Kevin just to sketch those out for us for a moment, and then we'll hone in on the three that we're going to look at today.
Thanks, Duncan. So those five pillars, quite broadly, one takes a look at the actual history of the estate, because we don't quite know how much money was actually made and what was the legacy of that. Because recognized that the priests who come out of Cogdenham College are in fact those early missionaries in North America. And then almost a century later, some of those same priests are missionaries in West Africa, all coming out of this seminary, which has been provided money by the labor produced by enslaved Africans on this tropical plantation. So we need to understand that. So there's a deep dive into the history of the site. Along with that deep dive, in a co-community partnership, is to identify where are the burial grounds of the enslaved people who lived on that plantation. And one, the reason why that's important, closure, understanding. In a plantation space where after emancipation in 1838, there's almost a complete erasure of enslaved villages and enslaved burial grounds. So this year, for the first time in almost 30 years, there was an archaeological field school at the Codrington Estate using primarily Barbadian and West Indian student archaeologists. Why is that important? It's about building capacity. It's about ensuring that there's another generation of West Indians who can actually study their own archaeology and by extension add to their own history. That's one and two. Third, the trust inherited a tenantry. So there's a leasehold tenantry that is created after 1838. What we're seeking to do is to have approximately 200 tenants become freehold landowners. There are issues around that, both legal and otherwise, and the fund will help us to deal with those issues so that leasehold tenants can become freehold landowners. And why is that important? In 2024, 2025, why is a former plantation estate still having tenants? Why is the land not owned by the people who live there? And that is what we're trying to achieve with this. That for us is part and parcel of what reparative justice could look like on this former estate. The other is looking at what we would call social engineering. What are some of the educational and business opportunities that we can provide to the people who live in the environs of the estate to ensure not only sustainability, but really and truly the prosperity of wealth for the next generation? And of course, the last one has to do with the church itself. It is a church that rationalized the enslavement of African peoples, and therefore it lies with the church to effect repair in what one would refer to as reparative theology. And what better place for that to happen but at Codrington College? So that, in a nutshell, is where we are. But the key things here are access, co-community involvement, and reflection. We're not going to get it right. In fact, I'll say to you that this is the first attempt at a reparative justice project within a formerly enslaved space in the English-speaking Caribbean. So we're hoping here not simply to set the benchmark, as civil society has always done in relation to issues of trauma, but also to illustrate to our respective governments, this is in fact what can happen and what you need to do to ensure effective repair. And you might ask, why 15 years? We began this talk in 2023 on the grounds of a former plantation. 15 years brings us to 2038, the 200th anniversary of the ending of formal enslavement in the British West Indies. That's the importance of that date. So thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. It very much is, you know, that expression about you make the walk, you make the road by walking. And that's very much what this project is, because people haven't walked this road before particularly. So that's what we're seeking to do. I'm now, perfect timing. I was going to say, we are now going to go to Barbados and we're joined by Rosanna and Michael. Really lovely to see you guys. How are you?
Wonderful.
Are they hearing us?
Hi, how are you?
Yes, Duncan. We can hear you, Duncan.
Fantastic. Wonderful to see you. So Rosanna is one of our community representatives. And I'm just going to hand it back to Kevin just to have a little bit of a conversation about what that means, how that experience has been. We're kind of year into the project. And just got to open that out. So, and also just to hear what your kind of hopes and what you hope that this will look like in 15 years' time. We all need vision to see where we're going. So I'll hand over to Kevin.
Thanks, Duncan. Hi, Rosanna. Hi, Micah. So, Rosanna, you are one of two community reps involved in the repair project. First of all, what has that been like for you? And secondly, where do you want to see the project go?
I'm going to be very honest with you guys. It has been quite an experience, you know. We do have lots of work to do within our communities, within the tenantries, because persons have a lot of passion. I would use the word passion about the past, the history. And we do have lots of persons who are willing to work with us. We have some who are not so willing to work with us, but we're still working on those persons so that they could understand the vision of the project and where we want to get to, and not so much, you know, we're rehashing a lot of pain and hurt from the past. Yes, we have to do some repair there, but it's all part of the ongoing process in gaining their trust and helping this project to fruition. In 15 years' time, I can see most of the tenantries, you know, persons owning their own land, as we work with them to understand this process, I can see us developing the communities, enhancing the communities, even the mindset of the persons within the communities, because that is one of our biggest barriers, their mindset. Now, education, awareness. There are many persons with many talents within these tenantries. I'm hoping that within 15 years, we could have a location, and we were discussing it with the project, you know, so that we can have a home where these persons could come. We could do lots of training, teaching, future scope for financial literacy, in entrepreneurship within the tenantries, even helping persons just to share their knowledge and their wealth of knowledge about St. John, the history of the younger persons, having an outlet for persons within these communities to gather, and just to recreate that community spirit within the tenantries again. From that community, I'm all community engagement. So if I sound a little biased with the community spirit, please excuse me. Kevin will cover all the other pillars that we are going to cover, but I'm community based. Okay. So, you know, I'll be speaking for the communities and the future development of the communities. So we are hoping that as a team together, we can get all of these very moving parts together, and that we could really create a wealth of this passion within our community, positive energy to help the tenantries and the persons and families within the tenantries to just grow together, and helping Codrington to explore what options there are still within this community to bring more light to the Codrington estate, and for persons around the world to see that Codrington estate has a lot to offer besides a wealth of culture and a wealth of knowledge and history, our people, we do have a lot to offer the community within us and within our territories.
Oh, thank you so much for that. Let me also introduce Micah, who's one of the cohort of young archaeological students who this summer have been taught. I'm not going to bore you now. Geophysical techniques simply means the ability to explore the ground without having to dig into it in our archaeological field school. So I asked Micah, what was that experience like this year? And again, this is a project that for us will be ongoing for the next 5 years as we try to identify where the enslaved burial ground is. Once we find that, to go back to the community, because they're the one who gave the consent for us to go look for it. The other is, when we find it, what does the community then want to do? How do they want to commemorate this site? So Micah, what was that experience like this summer for you?
Well, hi, Kevin. Good to see you guys again. This summer was a lot of fun. We worked with the Raptor and the EM machine. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm having trouble hearing you.
Oh, it's gone. What's a Raptor?
Oh, a Raptor. It's a not too big kind of sled looking machine. A sled, but much more wires attached to it that we would push along the ground. We would push along the ground, and it sends waves into the ground, radiation waves into the ground, and it comes up as like a wavy kind of picture. And using it, you can see disturbances in the ground. You can see it shows you evidence of foundations of old buildings. So you could use it to find old villages, old structures like a wall or something like that. It also shows you, it's also pretty helpful if you're looking for burials. You know, because you can have an idea of where a burial might be. You can know an idea of where a burial is shaped towards. So you can use the Raptor, look at the waves showing up on the ground, and it shows you evidence of those types of things. So, and all this I learned this summer. I learned a crazy amount of stuff, extremely useful things. It's been pretty great. It's been a lot of fun.
Okay, thank you for that, Micah.
Can I just chip in there with a question, Michael? I think many of us, given this history, will be deeply shocked by the fact that enslaved persons' burial sites were not known. We didn't know where they were. They're not marked. They're not honored. They're not memorialized. And I'm just wondering whether you had any kind of, you know, kind of heart reflections around that, as you've got this fantastic technology, as you're using some really high-level skills. And it's a very technical and very scientific activity. But I'm just wondering for you as a person, you know, in those moments of reflection of that activity, what was sort of going through your mind or what were you kind of feeling or reflecting around that?
Well, it was interesting because these are my ancestors and there's been a willful attempt to kind of hide this and cover this stuff up. So, oddly enough, I felt a lot of pride. I felt a lot of, you know, in spite of everything people have tried to do to put people that look like me down, you know, you can use this technology, you can reveal history. So I felt a lot of pride. I felt, you know, I found something where I could finally help people and do a lot of good work while still scratching that technical itch, that, you know, the joy of working outside, those types of things.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Micah. Actually, that is an amazing answer. I need to put that in something. It is about pride. It is about recovery, which kind of meshes with what Rosanna talked about in terms of building that community empowerment through this project. And even though really and truly we're at year one in a way of actually being out in the field, for me, it's a very positive thing, especially when given the fact that some people are wondering, well, what are you doing? You know, you hear that, but slavery's in the past. Slavery is not in the past. As I said, we've not yet reached the midway point of where we have been freed longer than our ancestors were enslaved. And the structures, the space in which we inhabit, the businesses that we still business with would have been formed out of the economy created by transatlantic slavery. And here we are finally having a much long needed discussion of coming to grips with what that is and what it means. And as descendants, to understand that our ancestors survived a traumatic and horrible past. And it's not something for us to be ashamed of, but something for us to take pride in and to understand how they were able to navigate and innovate through what I can't even fully imagine was a truly horrific past. I guess my other question for Rosanna, in terms of community development, what are some of the things you would like to see come out of this project for the community?
So I have two budding things in mind to start with. We were hoping that, you know, we would be able to afford an infrastructure that would be built, that would be a multi-purpose infrastructure where persons can, we can have community training sessions, we can have courses, you know, to help persons with education, awareness. Persons who may be retired or at home, they could go during the day to keep them engaged. We have an aging population, so we also have to include those. We have the youth coming up. Let's have some courses for the youth, guidance, nurture them, you know, so that we can have some outstanding young people in our near future. As it relates to that specific community, cricket is a sport that draws a lot of persons within our community. So we are hoping that this facility could do training. It could also do events where persons gather and they come, they do their thing. We have sports, we have positive engagement within the community. We also have an area where we can encourage persons who have small businesses to come and set up, let's say like once a month, promote their products, their services. So all of this is part of the development. And health is another thing. NCDs is another thing here. And I'm hoping that at this center, because of my medical background, sorry, I couldn't hear you.
No, I was going to ask you if you could say what NCD is, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. Non-communicable diseases. So these diseases are like your blood, high blood pressure, diabetes, obesity, high cholesterol, you know, like those kind of diseases, cancers, sorry. So because of my other background, I'm very passionate about this area, and I would volunteer my services and my time free of cost to educate our community on health awareness. And we are hoping that this facility, as I say, we have so many ideas, but it has to be multi-purpose and managed accordingly and taken care of so that everybody within the community could benefit from this infrastructure. In terms of other areas of the community, I would like entrepreneurship as a scope to help persons to be empowered and not be timid when it comes to their ideas. A lot of persons have wonderful ideas, but they're just shy and not confident that they could promote their own business or start their own businesses. And this could also help encourage financial literacy so that these persons better able to manage their businesses. They have an outlet where they can make their money. And it could also teach persons that no matter where you come from, you can still have a thriving business. So it's all about helping and empowering persons in whichever way we can, so that we can help heal our community and help persons to just find the way forward. That's my scope. Just let us find our way forward in a positive light.
Thank you very much for that. Yeah, that resonates a lot. And as I said, on that day, sitting across the table from the representative of USPG, that is some of what was discussed. So we're really looking forward to being able to bring that to fruition with this project and with the help of not only you, but the help of the other community members as well.
Thank you so much for being with us. And don't run away, stay there. If you got the time, that would be fantastic. One of the things that I think is very powerful for us in this, and perhaps especially for me as someone on a journey and learning, is just to really grasp the intergenerational legacies of enslavement rolling down the generations. And I think we've had a couple of illustrations there. The level of diabetes, for example, in the Caribbean is a very good example of a sugar economy, it is entirely unsurprising. So diabetes and trying to repair that situation through health interventions is one good example. A second is the fact that, Kevin, as you were saying a little earlier, 30 years ago, you were involved in an archaeological dig. That was the last time it happened. So the fact that the academy, that archaeology has been dominated by Northern academics in the US and the UK, and you haven't had access to those experiences and those resources and to the raptor and to those kind of technical elements. And this is building the next generation on that side. And then perhaps just a third thing to touch on, Barbados is very, very rural. But unsurprisingly, because of the history, people are not that interested in working the fields. Obviously, you know, that you can just, you can feel that. And yet that sort of reappropriation and re-ownership in here, as well as anywhere else on the land, is a really important part of things.
Oh, very much so. It's not even re-ownership. It's simply ownership. I mean, one of the reason why tenantries got created in the first place was to deny the newly freed people ownership of land. Because ownership of land meant one had the ability to vote. And if one had the ability to vote, one could potentially disrupt the ongoing power structure as it was at that point in time. So the ownership of land is not simply to say, this is the land I own. It is in fact a means of generational wealth. It is a means of empowerment politically and also mentally. When you own the land on which you live, it does something to your psyche. You have not just greater pride, but a sense of empowerment that you would not normally have if you did not own that space in which you live, and then in which successive generations could come and inherit and build on. So it becomes really one of those foundational building blocks for any society. And I think that is part of what we're trying to repair here. What has been a historic injustice, and to find a way in discussion with communities, what are some of the practical things we can do to address not only the historical grievance, but also to deal with the day-to-day practicality of life. A lot of which has been almost caused by and as a result of this particular system which we've now found ourselves in. And I think that becomes one of those longitudinal examinations of this project. Hence why 10 to 15 years. One can only hope that after 10 to 50 years, as one does the evaluation, there's then another renewal of 10 to 15 years, because this cannot be a one-off project. This must have a certain level of sustainability and commitment on both sides of the Atlantic to ensure that whoever is going to be at Greenbelt 100 years from now, so remembers, hey, you remember that old image of those guys on the stage? They look kind of weird. but remember what they were talking about? Well, we've actually gotten a fair way with that. You know, the majority of people who now live on that estate are in fact creating businesses and thriving from the space in which their ancestors were once enslaved on, simply because these were the building blocks that were started 100 years ago. And I think if that were to happen, that for me is success.
We're going to go to question and answers in a few moments' time. And because we started late, we're going to do questions and answers until we're kicked off the stage. But just before we do that, we're very honored to have a fantastic theologian in the audience here today, who's going to take a moment or two to get up from his seat and possibly come up this side here and take my chair. So I'm going to welcome Carlton Turner to come and share some reflections. Thank you, Carlton. He did have a little bit of warning, you know, because this is about renewal, reconciliation, and repair. These are big words, And I think it'd be really helpful if we had some theological reflection from Carlton. So Kevin will fire some questions at you, but in your hands, sir.
Thank you. And hello, everyone. Hello, Greenbelt.
Right. So let me start off by saying that when we were told that a USPG was coming to Codrington to have a discussion, we had no idea who we would be meeting with. So we walk into the room and they're the trustees of USPG. But lo and behold, amongst the trustees is a former student of Codrington College and the Reverend Carlton Turner. So it was in a way refreshing to see someone who had that lived experience in about how we were going to seek to effect repair at that time. And because Carlton is a theologian, I guess my question really is about how do we deal with redressing the complicity of the Anglican Church in the enslavement of African peoples?
So, hello, everyone. And that's a big question. I think just going back to where I'm and how I'm involved in all of this. So 20 years ago, I went to train at the only Anglican seminary in the Caribbean, a former slave plantation. And the interesting thing is, by the time I had left, I realized I had no Caribbean theology taught to me of any significant length. And if you know me as a personality, I got pissed off and decided that I would study it and would do something about it. But God has been good in that now we are at a place where we can look at all that we're doing theologically and realize how problematic it has been. And if you get to know how I think, it's usually the things we are most unconscious about that we need to pay attention to. And theology has been one of these things that has been undergirding all of this trauma and this exploitation. And the only way to address it would be a new kind of theology, a new kind of consciousness that looks at itself first before it acts. So if you were to ask me, how do we deal with it? Look at ourselves. And for me, I happen to be, yes, I'm somebody who is from my ancestors, the enslaved.
Thank you.
But I'm also the Church of England priest. So it's a complicated situation where you're part of the very system and you are on either side. So really, the attention, the theological gaze needs to be very careful and very honest and very serious about all the complexities of who I am and how this history has marked my life and our lives together.
Okay. So for me, as a historian and an archaeologist, it begs the question, how do we decolonize the church?
Oh, Jesus. I've been doing a lot of writing on this and informed by who I am and where I've come from, as we all do. And I start to see the church in other ways other than we've normally been looking at the church. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I'm attentive to is the psychological nature of the church. We talk about colonization as if it were something that happened historically. And we could forget about it. There are no bodies impacted. There are no human beings. There are no children and their children. It's just something that happened. But what if we realize there are psychological histories of trauma that are still living today? What if we begin to see the church as a system that can be functional or dysfunctional? And if we were to see it as an entity that is quite destructive, then we can start to address it properly. But it's how we see things that determines how we respond. So in the decolonial conversations, I wish we were using other insights, other expertise like theology, like sociology, like the health sector, to really look at ourselves, because I don't think we are in the habit of doing that. And this would be my wish. And it's about being open, humble, and frankly honest, frankly humane. So,
well, I look forward to seeing how that evolves as we continue with this project. Because again, when we do that deep dive into the history, some of the language and processes used to, I dare say, psychologically enslave through scripture needs to be deconstructed.
Yeah.
And I think that is when we begin to take a look at what you're looking at. What I'm going to say now, we've got about 15 minutes left. I would love for us to have some questions and questions actually from the audience.
So I've got a roving mic. What I would say is if you've never asked a question at Greenbelt before, if we're talking about decolonizing the Bible, how about decolonizing Greenbelt? If you've never asked a question before, go for it. This is the day. Go for it.
No.
Okay, I've got one and two there.
And three.
It's a question about how you give the land, the ownership back to people. Yeah. And I speak with all humility as a homeowner, so I appreciate and understand that. But how can you ensure that that land, those homes, those businesses stay with the community? I just think of our own council housing sell-off. It hasn't helped this country.
Yeah. Well,
what can we learn about how you plan to do it?
That's going to be interesting. Okay, so let's start with the land first. So in 1979, the governor of Barbados created something called the Freehold Land Tenantry Act, which by law stated that if you lived on a tenantry, the owner, the plantation owner, had to sell you that land at 10 cents a square foot. Now, in the parish of St. John, land can be sold anywhere from, I'm going to use British pounds, 3 pounds, to maybe 8 pounds a square foot. But in this instance, you're saying to people that you can purchase that land at 3.5 pence per square foot. But it's a mental thing. Some people thought, well, if I buy the land, I may have to pay land tax. Because we've been doing a series of town hall meetings to understand why people haven't taken up what is a fairly old piece of legislation. And that was one of the barriers. So we did some investigations and we recognized that, that's not the case. There's a cap. Land must be 35,000 pounds of value in order for you to pay land tax. That's not the case here. The other that we started to do is that if you own that land is potentially collateral to build a home or to be used to send a child to school. And we're hoping that by doing so, people don't quickly just want to sell it off for profit. Now, the financial literacy that was mentioned by Rosanna now that comes into play as we begin to roll out those business loans and have to be loans because they need to be repaid so that it's continually replenished. And you're hoping that that type of education allows people to recognize it as the potential for generational wealth and not simply a quick fix. Let me sell this, get some quick money, and, you know, whoever comes after me is up to them to sort themselves out. So it's education on the one hand, re-education on another. And the fact that by having this land, this is an asset for you and your family for generations to come. That's the hope and that's the wish. I might have a bigger wish that maybe people should think alongside us of looking at a building society so that you can create that and therefore the generation of that revenue is circulated within that community over time. That's another aspect of generational wealth as well. But I also think, as if all things, as we begin to implement, we should always evaluate and see what works and not be shy about admitting that is not working and to pivot till you get something that works. For too long, we go along and go along and go along until you wake up one morning and literally the land on which your house stands is no longer yours. We don't want that to happen. So there's a sense of vigilance and education that must be continuous in order to ensure that long-term sustainability and also wealth generation and prosperity for the next 5, 6, 7, 8 generations. Yeah, but fantastic question. Work in progress. Work in progress. There's a gentleman in red and there was a lady.
We've got a lady here and yeah. Then.
Lady there and a gentleman in the red
yeah,
t-shirt.
The one there, yeah.
Yep, there you go.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I can't remember your name in the middle there.
Carlton.
I did notice your answer when the question about how do we decolonize the church was asked, and your answer was, oh, Jesus. And you talked earlier about the fact that we need to look inwards.
Yeah.
We need to start to look inwards. And I just wondered whether you might be able to elaborate on, when we look inwards, what are some of the critical questions that we need to grapple with and be asking ourselves?
Mm-hmm. Oh, Jesus. No, let me not get all, I'll try and be brief, but what I'm referring to is a whole lot of our responses seem to be more cerebral, but we're not looking inward in how we have acted and asked the further question of why. And also why we can't see in the first place. And I think within, when you, we have to wrestle with inherited power, we have to wrestle with empire, and we have to wrestle with the fact that we are not remote from this history. I mean, interestingly enough, a little over 100 years ago, my ancestor was the first black priest in the Bahamas. 100 years later, I'm on a USPG scholarship to do theology in the UK. He was trained by a SPG priest. So my life is all bound up with a long history of entangled oppression. And it takes a lot of courage to look at our implicatedness in these entangled histories. So we need the historians to do the work. We need to listen to people who are oppressed. We need to listen to our ambivalent nature. We need to listen to why we don't speak out enough. And that takes a lot of, we're not talking about the right answer. We're talking about the willingness to be courageous and to do what's right. You know? And we need to look and think about bodies. Real people have survived this real shit. Let's deal with that. And I think theologically we need to, that inward gaze. I'm talking about all of this kind of stuff. So I think I saved the big cerebral answer. And oh, Jesus is the right one.
Hi, thank you so much for your presentation. Has there been a discussion about renaming the estate and the college to lose the name of that slave owner?
Not yet, but I see that coming. Again, as I said, this is very much driven by community, but I see it coming. And it'd be interesting to see how people would want to rename it. What is the mechanism by which we rename it? And in renaming it, to reclaim it as ours. And I'll give an example. In Barbados, there's actually an enslaved burial ground on the Newton Plantation. For a very long time, it was simply referred to as the Newton Burial Ground. It privileged the plantation in its name. over the last 2 years, there's been a flip. It is the enslaved burial ground at Newton. So you start with what it is first. It is the enslaved burial ground. And then you note the name because that simply is a place of location. You don't privilege that name. So I wait to see how community seeks to deal with the legacy of Christopher Codrington and how they would wish to reflect on and perhaps change. I know there's some people that will be cringing, but if we are going to evolve the same way that we no longer speak of Cecil Rhodes, why do we need to speak of Christopher Codrington?
Can I just chip in there? And I just wonder whether, if Rosanna heard the question clearly, I wonder whether she had any reflection from the community as to how you feel people might be thinking about the name of the estate and whether they would be saying, yeah, we should do that, or I'm not sure. Rosanna, were you able to hear the question? Doesn't look
Just
like.
Repeat for me one more time.
So the question was, how would the community at Codrington feel about renaming the estate to lose the name of Codrington?
That would be very interesting. There are many persons who will be like, yeah, let's just get rid of that name. Maybe some of the older folks may be like, no, you can't get rid of the name. It still has meaning to us. So we may get some mixed emotions, but you're definitely going to get some passionate emotions on both sides.
Thank you. I think that was really clear.
Probably got time for just two last questions. So I've got two people been waiting. If we've got time, we've got two already. And then we will have gone over slightly, but you know what? That's fine because we started later.
As an Anglican priest as well, I visit lots of churches around, and very often they raise this subject about reparations, but their question is, why do we even bother with this? And I struggle to know how to answer that well. So can you help me to know how to reply about reparations more than just the initial injustices? How do I say this is really important? We've got to do this.
As a non-priest, I'll give my answer and I'll turn it over to theologians. If you were in the West Indies or if you were in North America, the building that you're in which you're holding service was created from the enslaved labor of Africans. The chalice from which you drink your wine was purchased by the enslaved labor of Africans. And it could also mean that the church in which you are worshiping in the United Kingdom was built by the enslaved labor of Africans, because the particular Lord within your shire gained his money either directly or generationally from the labor and wealth from enslaved Africans. So in fact, you live this every day. And I would point to Harwood House in Yorkshire as a fantastic example, and signal them out as well as being honest enough to say where their money came from, whilst other great estates do not. So it is a lived experience. You walk into that space every day and you worship in this opulence, but never ask the question, where was this built? How was it brought here? Where did it come from? And if you answer that question honestly, you would understand that reparations, in fact, is an atonement for past atrocity. And if you are not able to do that, then the tenets of the faith to which you say you believe in, you are making a mockery of, says the layperson. I turn over to the theologian.
I'll quickly answer that, as I'm guessing the majority of people who say that to you look a little bit more like me. And I would say two things. One is, go back to the Old Testament, look at the Ten Commandments, and see how God, as it were, self-describes before those Ten Commandments. I am the God who brought you out of Egypt and out of slavery. Within the Bible, history is important. We remember, we lament, and justice is fundamental. Reparations is about the addressing of injustice, which is delayed and profound. And at the end of this, and this I think is really critical, the word reconciliation is foundational here. We are sisters and brothers in Christ. It doesn't matter what our skin color is. We are absolutely together and interconnected. We will never be fully reconciled if we do not bear the burdens and pick up the wounds and do the listening from our sisters and brothers. We will not be fully human. Will we not be fully who God wishes us to be? So those would be my answers. It's foundational to who we are as Christians to remember, to repent, to look for healing.
Preach it, Duncan. No, but as a priest, as a black man, as an African Caribbean person, I hear that question quite deeply. But, in moving from across the Atlantic, I've had to do a whole lot of navigating and trying to figure out who am I in this. And my conclusion is that we're all in this. I'm no less priest than you are. And we might be from different backgrounds, but we're part of the same church. And I think we, just how Kevin said, this history is always there. Everywhere you go and in every shape and everything you do, you can't run from it. So our church, no matter how you feel about it, we have a lot of work to do about our own past and be honest about how the past hasn't gone away. It walks with us. It walks in our processes. It walks in our conversations around racism or any kind of ism that we're dealing with. It's because we need to look at ourselves. And so my biggest thing is, if someone were to say that to me, I would say, my brother, my sister, my whoever, we have the same issue to deal with. But we can't not deal with it. We have to face it.
This time last year, I was in this same space, and a black theologian was giving a talk about reparations. I've forgotten his name, but he said the cost of reparations would be in billions of pounds, not the small amount that USPG's been able to put in to this project. Just a comment.
Right. So my comment there is absolutely correct. And from the beginning of this project, it was acknowledged that the funding is inadequate. And it was also acknowledged that the project is a reparative justice project and not a reparations project. Words matter. Reparations, Virginia Seminary in the United States is engaged in a reparations project where they have tracked down the descendant families and are giving money because, they've got the money to give. But the reparative project at beginning is to, in a way, flesh out what can be done, what is possible. And we've always said at the beginning of this project that this is just the beginning, because we haven't been able to total what was actually earned and the legacy of that. And we're hoping that we get there. But it was always acknowledged from the beginning that the amount was inadequate, but that we needed to begin. It has taken too long for there to even have the discussion around reparative justice, and that, in fact, we must begin it, but recognize that it doesn't have that absolute end. So I can only hope, and I'm putting USBG years now on the spot, that when we come to the midway point and we do the reflection and the reevaluation, and we recognize that there's need for additional monies to carry out the reparative justice that is forthcoming. But it is inadequate. And truthfully, it will never be adequate. You enslaved my ancestors for over half a millennia. I will never know where I came from. I will never understand the origin language of my people. But what I do know is where they ended up. And I understand the society that they've sought to create. And we now need to effect repair because the generational trauma is not just psychological. It is also physical. And it is also structural. And we've got a long way to go to make those particular amends. And it isn't about guilt or shame. It's about humanity. It is about recognizing that there was a wrong and seeking to redress that wrong for however long it would take to redress. And I think that for me is the crux of humanity. And that for me is the crux of the religion and the God that we say that we believe in and serve. I hope that helps.
What a remarkable session, and what a note to end on. Thank you so much, Kevin. Thank you to all our guests, and thank you to USPG for bringing this session to us today. Our next session should have been started at 12:30. It's now going to have to go on slightly, but so it will start at about more like 1:55. So if you're staying, please do. You're in for a fantastic session. But can I just have one last amazing Greenbelt round of applause for our speakers. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you to Rosanna and Micah for joining us from Barbados.
Hello, Rosie.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.